Today on Against the Grain, if radical transformation is the goal, if neoliberal systems and regimes are to be brought down and replaced, then what kinds of political projects and initiatives have been changing what needs to be changed? I'm CS. The political theorist Robert Latham presents a plethora of ideas and provocations in his new book, The Politics of Evasion. You'll hear from him at length, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. If the state, the nation-state, isn't working, isn't on the side of social justice, then what do we do? Do we seek a return to the welfare state, or do we work towards something else? Do we confront the state head-on, or do we work around it by creating pockets of community that put into practice values different than those propagated by neoliberal securitized regimes? Robert Latham is a political theorist who's written a provocative book about what has worked and what is working today to foster fundamental social transformation. In The Politics of Evasion, a post-globalization dialogue along the edge of the state, Robert Latham puts forward a notion of recollective passage, which involves turning away from dominant socio-political relations and enacting new ways to organize and reorganize collective life. The book is framed as a dialogue between Latham and another person, a fictional policy analyst named Mr. V. Robert Latham is an associate professor at York University in Toronto, where he teaches in the political science, communication and culture, and social and political thought programs. When Robert joined me from a studio on the York University campus, I asked what he saw as the overall project of his book.
It really starts from two different political perspectives. And one perspective on the part of this Mr. V is a commitment to the social democratic state and society, a desire to return to what was understood as emerging out of the earlier 20th century from, let's say, the Great Depression onward and the FDR regime and all the various welfare state concepts and practices that came about, and a commitment to an emerging post-war celebration of labor and rights and work that was part of this bargain that took place after the war, the Second World War, versus another attitude which says, well, we really can't go home again, so to speak, that not only was the social democratic state or welfare state or liberal democratic state seen as resting, let's say, on an imperial system and on deep exploitation of labor and racism, sexism, go on with those sort of lists. On the other hand, it really doesn't work for advancing human progress, rights, justice, equality. And that's the basic starting point of the book.
Tell us more about what you don't like about welfare capitalism, about, you know, the social democratic state as you've defined it. Because a lot of people would say, well, you know, that was a pretty good time after the New Deal. And, you know, there was sort of a, you know, workers were treated better and there was less inequality. There was a more egalitarian distribution of income and wealth back then, let's say in the 1950s. So why don't you want to go back to that system?
Yes, I think there was more equality just because there was less inequality, which has become obviously much more pronounced and profound now. But as I mentioned, if you think about all the various forms of racism and exclusions that took place, not only for, let's say, Aboriginal communities, Native Americans, but for African Americans, Latinos, what was underneath all of that, mostly white privileged celebration of working class or middle class, sort of white collar, that the disparity of their pay compared to the top executives was not as great. What actually sat there was a a profound sense of inequality, great limits that were put on what could happen and what could not happen, what the possibilities were. I mean, we're in the middle of a Cold War. Most of this welfare state was actually operating with the Cold War, enacting the Cold War, emerging out of World War II. So war footing for this, the military-industrial complex was a strong part of it. Deep entrenched bureaucracies, large corporations that were roaming around the world exploiting resources and communities, millions and millions of deaths, destruction. So for me, that is enough of a kind of damnation for it to say, wait a second here, just going back to that and just returning there doesn't seem to work. So that's the problem I see, basically, and whether or not we can actually organize differently, think in different ways in terms of harnessing the energies on the left. That's the other side of it, where let's really take seriously these possibilities other than that return to the welfare state.
Now, you find hope in what you call recollective passage, and we'll be focusing a lot on that term and what it means during the course of the hour. But I want to start with deployments, because you speak of a sort of passage away from deployments. If we start with that term deployments, do you mean by that the array of forces deployed by the state?
Yes, exactly. That's what I see as the core logic, that really, if you think about the state, we can understand it, obviously, in legal and symbolic terms. I mean, all sorts of forms of institutionalization and organization of an identity for a territory and forms of power and military force and so on. There's that level. But there's also the material level of the state, which has been emphasized for a long time, in 150 years. I mean, Marx and many other radicals of the 19th century, including some of the anarchists, made a lot of effort to pinpoint these things, the courts, the military, the police, and so on, all these various institutions, these real material forces that we might call, you know, forces on the ground. And if you think about the state, that it's really present through a deployment, some center, and typically, I'd say in the U.S. case, Washington, D.C., sends a piece of itself, some office somewhere, to another space. It's not unlike, in some way, the way that you see a imperial force sends a piece of itself, an army, a colony, to another space. So the federal government, for example, sends a certain office and group out to North Dakota, opens up a certain office, right? Enters that space. So this is really how it's organized in a material way. If we look around, well, where's the state, right? We see it in these various pockets of bureaucracy, of administrators, of offices. So those are deployed. And I'm using that word, yes, to convey the military sense, right? We talk about military deployment. So it's a way of understanding the state as a kind of quintessentially military form. And because of that, it raises the problem of whether or not, however well-intentioned and however justice-oriented your approach to the state is, if you're resting on that model, if that's how you're going to always relate to individuals, to communities, to spaces, then that's going to cause a problem for anybody who's seeking actually to change things and see the real justice that they're after.
Now, the state, the nation state in the U.S. and many other nations operates under what's called a neoliberal economic regime. It's not just an economic regime, a neoliberal economic political regime. And you write the passage starts from conditions like neoliberalism. Let me get your definition of neoliberalism.
I take neoliberalism as a, and there's many ways to understand it, I can't go through it, but I understand it in a sense intuitively as an attempt to harness the state to advance financialization, privatization, corporate power, the use of all forms of the state's apparatus, from infrastructure like water, electricity, for the advantage and the benefit of corporations. In some cases, it is so-called marketizing things, creating a market for something. For in many cases, we're not dealing with really markets. We're dealing with corporate power, very hierarchical forms of control, inside deals made between parties of the state, parties of corporations. And that, to me, is a kind of essential way of understanding it, and also intuitively to see what's really going on here in the end and what's different from a non-neoliberal form where you're actually dealing with, let's say, forms of public control of resources, bounded sectors where corporate power cannot enter or be determining or taking over resources and shaping the actual economic life and so on. So that's where there's a difference. So not that under non-neoliberalism, pre-neoliberalism, there wasn't lots of corporate power and capital was not essential. It's just that it reached a point where it could go into the state and, in a sense, use the state for advancing all of the things I mentioned, the privatization and the advancement of corporate power and so on, the colonization of sectors of life, for economics, for consumption, and so on, for finance, massive systems of finance and complicated arrangements that we associate with things like derivatives and forms of debt and so on. Those were all part of the package. And I think that was the kind of revolution that was central in neoliberalism, was to say, wait a second, it's not just about, you know, having more markets and arguing for markets in distinction to the state. It's by, let's go into the state. Let's really now exploit it. And lots of state exploitation happened through the centuries. And you can look at some of the histories of the 19th century and see what happened with railroads and canals. And we have depressions in the late 19th century, early 20th century, where we see massive financial power at play. But this became a systematic transformation. And it obviously was global. And it was really became organized as a way of doing things differently, not just pockets of difficult and troubling outcomes with large financial firms and J.P. Morgan or large corporations and Mellon and so on. This was of a different order. Continuous with that past, of course, but a sort of qualitative shift that became quite different.
Robert Latham joins us on Against the Grain. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at York University in Toronto. And he's author of The Politics of Evasion, a post-globalization dialogue along the edge of the state. It's recently out from Routledge. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica. And to continue and perhaps begin to wrap up our discussion of some foundational issues or aspects, hypersecurity, so that, again, you write the passage, which is what you're interested in describing and advocating for in this book, starts from neoliberalism and conditions like hypersecurity, by which you mean?
Yeah, hypersecurity, again, like neoliberalism, there's a major shift, a qualitative transformation in the treatment of security as internal to forms of life that hadn't been, in a sense, subject to it the way it had in the past. So most obvious example is all of the forms of surveillance that are being carried out by organizations like the National Security Agency. And we obviously see the revelations of Snowden, Edward Snowden. We've seen interesting things from WikiLeaks and other whistleblowers of various form. That's entering into a level of security that is much greater than it was in the past. It's also with hypersecurity, as I term it, we're also, in a sense, making it far more central a category for any government agency to actually evaluate what they're doing or not doing and making judgments about what's at stake. Understanding the border is not just about governing a population, but carrying out very intensive security policies. And we're seeing that now today, maybe carried to a extreme of the Trump administration. And it's a good example of, if you look at a just a little antidote, if you look at a movie from the 1950s and you look at border crossing, you'll see people basically showing up in some cases, let's say from Mexico, in their car and saying, oh, I'm an American citizen. Okay, where do you live? And maybe looking at a document and perhaps not even just going based on what they understand to be an American accent. That versus what we now see at the level of scrutiny and so on tied to security logic. So that's a pointed example of what we're talking about. We've reached a different level, just like with neoliberalism. It's continuous with the history of capitalism, but it's shifted and organized in a different way that we can understand as a qualitative difference, and the intensification is noticeable.
So, you know, we have all these things, these systems, these regimes that you don't like. And a lot of people would say, in fact, the interlocutor, your interlocutor in this book, The Politics of Evasion, which is framed as a dialogue between you and an imaginary Mr. V, a fictional Mr. V, he believes that then what you need to do is you need to take the state and get rid of it in its current form and replace it with something much better, more socially just. And yet, in this book, you are advancing a notion of passage, as I mentioned before. Is this a passage away, a movement away from the circumstances and institutions you've been describing?
Yes, that's a good way to look at it. It is a movement away. I mean, the image I always keep in my mind is like a black hole. Think of a plane of some space. Let's say that plane is social and political life, let's say in the United States. And you open up a space, you try to break away from that plane, and the sort of hole opens up and you move away into another future. Now imagine that that plane becomes populated with lots of these kind of black holes, so to speak. And the terrain starts changing. You start transforming. And so the reality of what's faced by any political actor, economic actor even, is changed. So it's different. That it's no longer as coherent as it once was. So those passages are about trying to move. I use the word deflection, deflect away, doing something different, sort of bouncing off of the existing form, deflecting from, turning away from that existing practice. And there's very mundane examples and very complicated examples. One of the most simple examples I ever think of is community banking. Think of a group in, let's say, the Midwest, a community that says, well, we're going to send our money to Wall Street. We're going to keep the money in the community or in the state, the region, the county, and so on. That's a deflection. You've now shifted. Now imagine that we had lots of these things going on. You saw an explosion. There was a scale-up of this practice. And as we know, there are organizations that are trying to advance this. And there is a history of this that goes way back, even into the 19th century, and in terms of farms and the granges and so on. But imagine that we start to see a real kind of proliferation. So that terrain begins to shift. In a sense, the holes begin to emerge. It's no longer as coherent as it was, let's say, if you're sitting somewhere in a large bank and you're thinking of, why are we now missing these funds, or why are these communities organizing differently? Why are they spending in different ways, and why do they have access to the money? Why is it not in our accounts the way it was 5 years ago? Why are they not borrowing from us? So that begins to transform. So that's one level of the passage, and there's the more radical dimensions as well. But that's another story where it could go from the other sort of arc of recollectivization, moving from the mundane example to the far more complicated examples of, let's say, large-scale social revolutions, like, let's say, in Cuba or other places.
So you would call the Cuban Revolution an example of what you term recollective passage. What is the recollective part of that phrase? What does that mean?
The recollective really reflects the notion that any group collective that's, in a sense, trying to deflect away, do things differently, finding a logic of difference, or finding lots of logics of difference, in the case of, let's say, Cuba, they're moving in another direction. They're reorganizing. They're devising other ways of organizing all the sectors of their life, their material and possibly cultural life. They're reforming their collective. Now, that's clear in terms of a large-scale revolution, as in the Cuban case, but they're also recollectivizing when that community, let's say in North Dakota, decides to set up a community bank. They are organizing it differently. It's a much more shallow version of it, and it's more, let's say, one-dimensional, dealing with, let's say, collective funds that the community has. But it's also a transformation. It's recollecting. Now, so there's a sort of this kind of wide range or arc of recollectivity, as one might say, starting from narrow or mundane to the far more radical and wide scale. But what's unique is the attempt to point to this deflecting and devising away. So recollectivizing also reflects the idea that we would look back at existing resources that are our histories, what we have, the thing, our lands, whatever, homes and things, and reorganizing that to recognize them for what they are, bring them into this new collectivity that we organize. So it's not just a open to the future and the past means nothing. It is also something where the past does mean things, but it gets put back into reconsideration and reorganizing through this attempt to think of the collective and sit down with all of our existing forms and resources and material forms of life and cultural and symbolic, and saying, how can we organize this differently where we, the large collective, is treated in an equal way, in a just way? And the idea is also the re-notion, and where the passage comes in that's very important to that, is that it's moving into the future, that it has to be left open. Open into the future, it's a never-ending process. Once you decide that it's over, we've done. You know, we're finishing here, this is good enough. Then, in a sense, you've stopped that possibility of recollectivity. You've, in a sense, you've formed, and you're just trying to consolidate and make it better, which risks not just the power of the bureaucracy taking over and just saying, well, we're going to administer life as is, but power forms, individuals, groups emerging who are saying, well, we're the ones that we're going to decide how this works best. We are the experts and so on. You really don't have any say because there's nothing open anymore. The way the world is this. So, and the thing is, when you mentioned Cuba, I mean, the cases in a sense, they did decide, okay, this is how it is, basically. I think they kept to some degree going on, but in many ways, they kind of locked in the system. So that's the key, is despite our desire for, let's say, the radicality of early Cuban Revolution, the question is, can it keep moving and changing and transforming, despite also the conditions that it always has to face? It's not easy. It's not something where people are just sitting around putting their things together and rethinking. They're facing lots of pressures. They're facing lots of counter forces, counter-revolution, constant challenge, fight back, and so on. So though the key is how one keeps things open, how does the collective, how does the individuals are part of this departure and that are going down the passage, how are they always feeling, hey, wait a second, we can sit down and we can organize this way, we can organize that way. Or some of the examples during, let's say, Chavez's time in office, where there were lots of these communes and various organizations that were constantly operating with this kind of logic, I think.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Robert Latham joins us. He teaches in the Political Science, Communication and Culture, and Social and Political Thought programs at York University. He's the author of The Liberal Moment and, most recently, The Politics of Evasion, a Post-Globalization Dialogue Along the Edge of the State. Robert joins me today to talk about his new book, The Politics of Evasion. So, recollective passage. Nothing personal, Robert, but it's a bit clunky and it might not grab people and catch on, but maybe it will, and maybe this conversation will help in that process. Why create a new term and concept, in a sense, although maybe I'm beginning to answer your question for you, but why create this new term when we have terms already like social revolution or radical social movements or prefiguration, which is often used to describe the effort to point to and put into practice desired ways of living and organizing, which I think must be part of recollective passage. Why create this new term and not just piggyback on an existing term?
The main motive is to find some of the common elements among all the different forms that you just described, and to distinguish those common elements from the things that fall outside of that. So if we can see the common elements between a social movement that is trying to change the logics of how things are organized, like change the way the border is organized, or do something as simple as change the way land and how people live, you know, say the squatters movement, that could be related to, let's say, large-scale revolution, or back to the community banking, to see that common element, which is that recollectivity. And perhaps recollectivism or recollectivity may be a better way to think of it than just the notion of the passage. I mean, the idea of the passage is just to emphasize that this is meant to move through the future, and meant also to show that these things have to have a certain bounding, and I use the word shielding in a way, because we can't just assume everything's going to be fine and open and not to be subject to forms of capture and forms of subversion by the state, various other forces that would want to do that. So these passages, and I'm in a sense inspired in that way by Walter Benjamin in his thinking of the passages, and he just was looking at commercial passages in France particularly, but also in his work and thinking, he pointed to the way these things got subverted, sometimes used in revolt and rebellion, or the way workers had used the passages differently than they had been intended, and so on. So, but the idea of the passage is that you are moving into the future, that you have an existing trajectory, that you're on a trajectory of transformation. So social movements, for example, organizing to, let's say, push for better policy on CO2 emissions or something of that nature, or water pollution, or let's say a change in the wage of something. Those are, in a sense, different. Those type of pressures on policy, distinct from this idea that we're actually focused on changing the logics, how things work, how they're organized. And sometimes, again, they can be small. So again, thinking of the community banking example, or the wide-scale examples of, let's say, the Paris Commune, where they consciously there in 1871, you know, kind of 72, were organizing for this. And basically, once they finally got into their autonomy during the Commune, they were able to, in a sense, totally change the nature of how decisions are made, democracy operated, the relationship between what could be seen as representatives and the people, wages, and so on. They completely transformed that. So that's the emphasis. So the recollectivity is trying to emphasize that. That's different than, let's say, for example, a revolt or a rebellion or something like LA 1992. You know, important expression of terrible frustration, anger, and politics as well. But it's quite different than this idea of people self-consciously trying to move forward in transforming and putting the emphasis on those changes in transforming and things that actually say we are changing the collectivity, whether it's a small organizational thing or a large one. As I mentioned, it's still part of the same basic distinct form that's quite different than these other protests or types of mobilizations, or networking to pressure, right? Or marching down the street with banners and so on. I'm not in any way denigrating any of those other forms. I'm just pointing to something distinct that also is operating in these forms, let's say, broadly speaking, of resistance and attempts to transform social life.
But it's not just people who, let's say, reside on the left, who want to change society, who want to transform power relations or, you know, social relations. I mean, there are a lot of people on the right. There are a lot of libertarians who want a transformation of society and are working toward it and are mobilizing and are in some cases demonstrating. Do these folks also fit within your passage idea?
Well, in a sense, they do at the very beginning. It the starting point of saying, well, yes, this is an attempt to reorganize. The problem is that they don't really have an interest in being recollective in any way, right? They want to achieve a certain type of society, and then they're done, which may resemble what we were talking about in terms of inclinations on the left that also want to achieve one certain sort of society, one way of organizing, and then kind of done, right? And if you look at any, you know, let's say Iran or the Iranian Revolution, 1979 and so on, they weren't seeking to open up a passage, a form of transformation going forward, of recollectivizing, of recollectivity. They were interested in creating the society that we have been watching unfold in the last decades. Any other movement on the right, let's say a conservative movement, the very notion of being conservative is about conserving, to create a certain type of society. Fixed notions go in. Yes, they change organizational logics, but they're really only interested in creating the particular form that they have modeled and so on. So yes, as they go along, of course, they'll make changes, they'll do reforms and so on, but they're after one particular model. So the idea of the recollectivism is really about keeping it open so that the people, if I can use that term, are always in a sense and have to be open to the possibility of changing again, holding things open to question and having the ability to say, wait a second, this is not going the way we intended, or this is leaving us out, or it's excluding us, it's non-democratic and so on. This has nothing to do with the two examples that I have in mind that I mentioned before with, let's say, certain forms of conservative right or the Iranian religious forms, very deeply orthodox forms, right? They're exactly in the other direction, even though they open up a space of transformation. So they do change. They create one moment in a sense of recollective in the sense, and it's over. So there's no passage, which is why having that qualifier of passage in a sense to understand what real recollectivism rests on is the ability to keep going into the future, always putting things at stake, and always leaving up that possibility, leaving open that possibility of yet again transforming. So I think that helps to distinguish what we understand as kind of right revolutions versus, let's say, left revolutions. And the left, I think that was very much consistent with many things that Marx had said, in the sense of not being willing to say, well, here's what the new society should be, and criticizing any group and any ideologues that try to say, here's what it is, here's the seven principles, and let's just put them into action. And he had ideas of how it should be, notions of communal relationships to land and resources and so on, and the nature of work. Yes, he had principles, but that was different than actually modeling a society. So he was a real recollectivizer in a sense, in his logic, I would argue.
That's the voice of Robert Latham. He's associate professor of political science at York University, and he's author of The Politics of Evasion, a post-globalization dialogue along the edge of the state. We'll take a short break and speak more with Robert about his book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Robert Latham, he teaches in the Political Science, Communication and Culture, and Social and Political Thought programs at York University. He's my guest today, and his new book is called The Politics of Evasion. It's recently out from Routledge. And on againstthegrain.org, you will find a link to his faculty page. It's Latham, by the way, his last name. You'll find a link to Robert Latham's faculty page at York University, as well as to the book, The Politics of Evasion. So by stressing, Robert, a kind of movement away from this system of neoliberalism and hypersecurity, as opposed to maybe a more confrontational approach, an attempt to maybe take down the state, you know, it smacks of anarchism, right? It smacks of being anti-state, not just anti this state, this neoliberal state, but not wanting a state in place. Is that fundamentally where your political instincts lie?
Not quite. I'm really, I say, on the cusp of both anarchism, socialism, and seeking ways that we can really learn from both of the traditions. And I think that really one of the key things for me is to recognize that, and as David Harvey, I think, pointed out, if I recall correctly, that even when you start talking about federation and you start talking about reaching a level where you have, let's say, autonomous communities that we understand in a kind of anarchist way, that are trying to connect to each other, right? Because people aren't going to just sit there in their local communities and not try to create a world, a region, and so on. They have no choice. I mean, to survive and so on, and to enrich their lives, they want to be doing that. Once you get to that level, then you start possibly actually, in a sense, recreating a state, even if you don't call it that. You start having rules for relationships, for exchange, and so on. So I'm really working in my mind at that juncture where we really can't necessarily get to the point where we have a sort of pure anarchism per se. We work at the cusp, and I think it's an interesting place to be because it opens up the best of what we can bring from anarchism and the best that we can bring from even notions of state socialism. And I think there's a way of understanding the state differently, that we don't have to have the state of deployments, the one that we have rested on for a long time through the centuries and has developed into a pretty intense machine as it currently exists. We could possibly have a state that is shot through with these different recollectives, recollective forms, that is open to, in a sense, being a recollective state. And I think I get inspiration there from Gramsci, where he talked about kind of the integral state, which combines civil society and political society, political forms and civil forms. The only thing is he went to the party and saw it as the emergence of a party state, and I would see it as an emergence of a state that's committed to the ethics of recollectivity, to recollectivism. So that it would be open, that it would be one where it was constant public involvement in shaping the policies and so on. I mean, it's beyond just participation. I think that looking back and seeing the incredible ethic and mind frame that we saw in the Paris Commune, as I mentioned, in 1871, that there was a real kind of almost short-lived way that they actually put together this kind of form of a recollective state in a way. So we actually have that as a model, I think, on one level. The question is, though, there's a bigger, wider world out there, and the forces that ended the commune, that were organized against it and destroyed it, are still out there. So the question then is, how do we start building these recollective forms that start changing the social terrain and the economic form, the political forms? We deal with the state, we don't ignore it, and that's where I think I don't believe in the notions of changing the world and without taking power and so on. I think that we have to confront the forms of power. It's not an either or. I'm partly in this book, one of the main missions is to avoid and get over the either ors that dominate a lot of our politics.
So you have said a number of times this hour, you've spoken about openness and how important openness is to the movement, the passage that you are advocating. And your interlocutor, your fictional interlocutor in this book, Mr. V, because this book is framed as a dialogue between you and this Mr. V, he has a lot of problems with that because openness implies a kind of indeterminacy. It suggests kind of an untethering from certain sort of bedrock principles that might unite people. So you might have all these different passages happening in society, but then if everyone's sort of open to revision and to reconceptualization and to a renewed kind of a different kind of strategizing than the current one, then it can get kind of, you know, chaotic and diffuse and confused and incoherent, that these various passages won't cohere in a way that will in fact lead to a recollectivized society. How do you respond to that?
Yes, and I would add that also the indeterminacy that's tied to an openness could be seen and is seen by the interlocutor as something that doesn't emphasize the bedrock of achieved results, right? No one wants part-time human rights. No one wants to reverse and see flux and so on, right? Because as we know, that's what something that we thought about in terms of capitalism is, you know, everything solid melts in the air and so on, right? These sort of things that have been thought of, you know, Marx had put it that way, and others have talked about this form. And basically, the problem is that, indeed, we don't want to see that. So the one way of dealing with that, in thinking about that, because that is the problem, if we leave things open and put them up for grabs, so to speak, we risk, right? We risk putting our achievements, whatever social justice we've achieved, up for grabs. And one response to that is that, one, the idea is not that the past is gone and everything's up for grabs. If people, in their rethinking of their collective, as they collectivize, recollectivize, they actually think of these past things as part of their resources in history. So they bring the things that they want to have in the new collective, the new form that they're reorganizing. And whether it's a broad version of reorganizing, even a small one, so women's rights and you know, various other forms of sexual rights and things of that sort would be brought along into the other forms so that that history gets carried. It's less risky, in a sense, than one might think. Yes, there's risks. Then there's no way to avoid the risk. Unfortunately, anytime you open up a moment, any revolutionary moment, unfortunately, there is the risk that those who have very narrow, closed notions of power or society will take over. Again, Iran, thinking of that revolution, how many people were involved, let's say, from communist trajectory, other form, other radical allegiances, were part of that revolution, and yet it ended up leading towards the current regime. And so this is always the problem. I mean, if any transformation, you open up the moment, and you're also becoming a little vulnerable to it settling and capturing, being captured by certain power forces. So the question is to think about what it means to open and who's in charge of the opening, and keeping in mind, wait a second here, we have to have a process for going forward. If we don't institutionalize the recollectivizing, we have to institutionalize that recollectivizing, then if we don't do that, we are vulnerable, yes, to some group consolidating and capturing the revolutionary moment or the transformative moment. And even the micro form, going back to our example of community banking, right? It's the same thing. If it doesn't, it could get captured by, you know, some form of a corporate allegiances and so on. Say, hey, okay, keeping the money in community, that's great. But you know what? Let's put them all into public-private partnerships, right? So we're always thinking about the notion of openness. We're thinking then about of how we actually we cannot limit it to public-private partnerships. And no one can say it's going to be this way and not that way. It's always us as a group with the ever-ready possibility of reforming again, which is a principle that one hopes keeps participation for the involvement in the collective, in collectivizing at the forefront of what's taking place, which is the sort of democratic element that's inherent in this idea of recollectivity.
Robert Latham joins us. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at York University And we were talking about his book, The Politics of Evasion, a Post-Globalization Dialogue Along the Edge of the State. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Robert, let me get back to this issue of the state, of the nation state, and how you feel about it. Because, you know, you say in some ways you want to move away from the state, but you've also told me that, you know, confronting the state is very important, and you could see a case in which a government, a state, being in passage or being open to recollective passage on the part of its residents, on the part of its people. And yet it just seems to me that given the kind of openness and flexibility and indeterminacy that you want and that would have to be part of this state, it just seems to me that, you know, it would be an incredibly rare thing for a state like this to emerge. It almost wouldn't be a state the way we think about nation states. So I just wonder whether you should just come out and say, if you believe it, that just states are inherently prone to fundamental injustice, and that to really think about a state that isn't that way is really kind of moving, is kind of a leap of faith, and it's a process of pushing our imaginations in directions that may never be achieved.
That's a fair question. I would answer it, and hopefully this is not an evasion, but I would answer it by saying that it's the state as it's currently organized and conceived is one that is inherently hurtling, despite good intentions and so on, towards injustices in these various forms that have been part of its history, even though some groups benefit at different times that are not even the top elites historically, as we spoke about earlier in terms of certain workers and so on. So the question is, how does one reorganize it? I mean, I think we have seen some examples. I mean, I think Chavez's Venezuela was trying to move towards that, made these transformations. They changed some of their, the original, I think, 2001, the land law opened up the possibility of collective ownership and communal decisions over land use, domicile, and so on. It was applied eventually, I think, even to the urban context not too long after that. Lots of other things were opened up, tons of communes, and there's works on this that are out there. People can find the research. And basically, we might even point even to a current example, a simple one, which is simple because the transformation is not as, let's say, radical as the Venezuelan case, Ecuador. So the current regime in Ecuador right now, I mean, made a very simple change not too long ago where they said that banks have to keep the money in Ecuador, or at least a certain large percentage, maybe as much as 60-70% at this point. And that opened up a huge amount of resources that could be invested in the public and public sphere activities, education, health, and housing, and so on. This was a good example of that exactly kind of recollectivizing that took place. They made an orthogonal kind of organizational change, altered the way the banks operate, and wow, it really led to something. Other things have taken place since then in the country. But there's an example now, where it's going and how far it's going to go with this transformation. Well, that's exactly the question of the passage, right? I mean, are they going to keep moving and rethinking and organizing how much of involvement of the collective will be in this, as opposed to right now they have a president that's pretty sophisticated and I think leading the charge in this endeavor, but that's not enough. So if he starts bringing in individuals the way we saw Chavez, you know, in a sense, organizing, facilitating, allowing, tolerating the bottom-up organization of all types of forms of collectives and communes in Venezuela, that could really be quite an interesting model if he's allowed to survive politically, because once, of course, it starts looking like it's interesting and working and wiping out poverty, dealing with inequality, well, this draws the attention of, you know, elite power structures, and of course, examples like that are not very welcome. So, however, that's, I think, the transformations that would be required. We have examples of that, again, even in these last decades. And the more of that, the more that we see leadership, and more importantly, we see cadres, individuals of society that are committed to this, I think the better chance there is of moving away from that older model that may be desirable because it's has a history and you know, it's tied with certain type of rights and commitments to the right norms of progressivism and so on, yet it also only comes together with forms of injustices, has been copacetic with neoliberalism in deep ways, as we saw in the Clinton administration, for example. So I think that we do have that. So we do have this other model as a possibility. But people, I think, have to start thinking of the state differently and not think of the state as something that delivers, that gives you something. The state has to, in a sense, be truly captured all the way down, not just at the center, at the height of power, but has to be captured in this more decentralized way. And the society, the terrain, I would think, to the last point, most importantly, has to be changed. So that's where the recollectivities, as they try to change the social relations, change the actual terrain within which the state operates. That's most essential of all, I would think, to actually transform that so that the political parties respond differently to a different world that's beginning to emerge in various places, locales, and across the society.
Yeah, and as you write in your book, the very existence of a state can rest on a great deal of fundamental injustices, even if it veers in a progressive direction. Robert Latham is author of The Politics of Evasion, a post-globalization dialogue along the edge of the state. He's also the author of The Liberal Moment, Modernity, Security, and the Making of Post-War International Order. But the focus today has been on the politics of evasion. Robert Latham is Associate Professor of Political Science at York University in Toronto, Canada. Thanks so much, Robert, for joining me.
Welcome, and thank you very much for giving me the time and your great attention.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.